In 3, 2.
Welcome to Life and Laughs Podcast. It's time to make it a great day with your host, a man who once saved his mom's life who was choking on a taco shell by performing the Heimlich maneuver. Here's Johnny Sanchez.
Welcome to Life and Laughs Podcast. So thankful that you're joining us. We have a guest host today, and well, he's really part of the show. It's our very own show psychologist, Dr. Bill with one L. Welcome, Dr. Bill. How's it going, man?
Well, hey, it's going good. How are you doing, Johnny?
Doing good. We're so grateful that you're filling in today on the show. Elias could not be with us today, so thanks for taking his spot. I know how much you like him and are going to miss talking about his hair products.
Well, hey, I will miss him, but hey, all I can say, it's about time I get this opportunity.
You got it. You got it today. Hey, I got to ask you this. I saw this on the internet. So think about this. What does TWI sound like? If you were to say that, what would it sound like?
Twi.
Okay. Now answer this. What does TWO sound like?
Two.
Oh, man, you got it. Dang it.
Hey, I'm a doctor, remember? All right.
Dang it. Most people will say twi and then two and not catch what's going on. I thought I could get you, Dr. Bill, and I didn't.
Hey, I'm not most people. I'm Dr. Bill.
The one and the only Dr. Bill with one L. Hey, Dr. Bill, I had another Johnny dumb moment. You want to hear a couple of these?
Well, I believe it. Go ahead.
You know, we're into the new year now. Most people have trouble. They usually write the new year as the old year. Like, for example, if you're writing a check, you would, you know, sign the date as 20, maybe January 12th, 2020, instead of 21. Well, what I did, I wrote the date as 1-27-28. Another dumb moment.
Hey, that really ages you.
1928.
I mean, right. Hey, we're getting older. Let's not speed it up, all right?
I agree. I totally agree with that. Some days I feel like I was born in 1928.
Do you have dumb moments every day?
I wouldn't say every day, but it's getting more and more often. I will say that. Let's go on to the next segment. This is called What Would You Do? What would you do? And number one, I want to ask you, Dr. Bill, what would you do if you found money while you're standing in the checkout line? What would you do?
Well, hey, I tell you, that's happened to me before, but I was a little boy and I kept it. But now, today, with my experience and age, I believe I would turn it in.
You would. You'd give it to the cashier.
I would give it to the cashier.
Okay. A lot of people may not do that, but that's good. I'm impressed with that. Here's another one, okay? What would you do if you were in a toilet stall and there was no toilet paper in the stall?
Well, hey, am I pooping?
Yes, you're in the stall. You're not at the stand-up urinal, so yes.
Well, I think I would ask somebody next to me, and if there's nobody in there, I think I would get out and walk around to the next one get the toilet paper.
You, like, you'd pull your pants up and everything, or you just...
Well, I didn't say that.
It depends on how much of an emergency, I guess, huh?
Right. You have to have toilet paper.
That reminds me of a time in junior high. I walked in and there was this like punk rock type dude. He was in a band. He had real long hair, this hood like character, earrings and all, you know, the band look, the 80s hair band. And I walk in and I guess he hears the door open. I'm in seventh grade. This guy was in ninth grade. And he says, "Hey, dude, be cool, man. Go give me some toilet paper." And I didn't know what to do, but I knew who it was because I saw him go in a few minutes before me because it was lunchtime. We were standing out there. I just turned and walked back out. And I said, "Oh, man, I'm sorry, man. I got to go."
Well, hey, you mean that guy could still be sitting there needing toilet paper? You know, he said be cool, and you were not cool.
I was not cool. Maybe, though, I gave him inspiration to write a song for his band.
Right. Well, all right. Well, what would you do? What would you do?
I would do-do. Well, I think the question is, would he do-do?
Right. Okay.
All right. Let's move on to the next one. Dr. Bill with one L. What would you do if you were watching a movie in a theater, in a public theater, and people were talking all around you, like someone next to you or in front of you was talking?
Right. I would quietly and kindly ask them to be quiet.
How would you do that?
Hey, it costs a lot to go to a movie now. So if you're going to take your family to a movie and spend that kind of money, everybody else should be respectful enough to be quiet. So I would just tell them that.
As opposed to like throwing popcorn at them and hitting them or something like that?
Hey, right. I'm not going to act like you.
It depends on how loud they are. If they're just a little loud, it would be popcorn. If they're really loud, it'd be like an M&M or a Milk Dud or something.
Hey, you know as well as I do, you're not throwing an M&M anywhere but your mouth.
I do like some M&Ms. I love me some M&Ms. Okay, next on our list, Dr. Bill, what would you do if someone was driving slow in the fast lane in front of you?
Hey, I'm just going to drive around them in the slow lane, past them, and look at them.
You're going to give them the look?
I'm going to give them the stare, and then I'm going to drive around and get back in the fast lane. I want to know what you would do.
You know, here's something I always try to tell myself first when I feel that anger coming up and someone's driving 50 miles an hour in the fast lane, in the passing lane, and it's speed limit 70 or 75. I try to say first, it's not their fault that I'm running late. That's the first thing I say. But if they're obviously 20 miles below the speed limit and you can't get around, first I kind of speed up to their bumper a little bit just to let them know to get over. And then there's always those people that, because you did that, they're mad. Now they're going to go even slower. Most people would get over and say, hey, this guy's need by, but a lot of people don't. Or then I would flash my light one or two times if they don't. And then I would eventually just have to wait and go around, like you said. And I have to fight the urge to give them the look. I try my best to keep looking straight. I'm not always good about that, though. I sometimes give them the look, too.
Well, do you have road rage issues?
When I was younger, I think, I wouldn't call it road rage. It would be road irritation, maybe. I wasn't violent or anything, but I would honk the horn or whatever, and I try everything. I mean, if I honk my horn, it's because there's about to be an accident. Other than that, I try not to do that because there's some crazy people out there. You never know what's going to happen if you honk your horn.
Right, sure.
Here's another one. What would you do, Dr. Bill, if you see the Subway guy? You're in the Subway restaurant. You see him fix your sandwich.
Are you talking about Jared? Because if I see Jared in Subway, I'm leaving.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see him in Subway from about 5 to 10, I think.
Probably more. Go ahead.
He's more worried about dropping the soap right now than the wheat bread.
Hey, no comment.
Okay, if you're in Subway and you see the guy fixing your sandwich with gloves on, but he just rang someone up at the register with those same gloves, pushed the buttons and everything on the machine, and also handed the money, the cash and the change back to them wearing the gloves. He took their money, gave it back, and then he comes back and starts to fix your sandwich. And this has happened to me before. What would you do?
Right, that's a good question. And that has never happened to me. And I eat Subway a lot because I like to eat fresh. So, I don't know what I would do, but I would be tempted to say, hey, could you just make me a sandwich again with some fresh gloves? Since I want to eat fresh, I think you need fresh gloves on.
Yeah.
That would be the temptation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and especially with COVID right now. I mean, this is pre-COVID days that this happened to me, and I didn't say anything, and I regretted it. I worried about eating that sandwich later. Now, if this was post-COVID days, I definitely would do that. I would have to say, hey, if you don't mind, I'm sorry. You know, do it very politely. But yeah, I would have to do that.
Well, hey, if you want me to wear a mask in your restaurant, then you need to use clean gloves to make my sandwich.
And you see this all the time, or I do, going through drive-through windows. They keep the same gloves on, and they're handing people's credit cards and cash, and they're protecting themselves, yes, but they're spreading other people's germs to every customer that comes through that window. So.
Right. that.
Yeah. A lot of people I know will hold out the machine and let you put the card in, but there's been several that don't do that.
Right.
Okay, here's the next one on our list. You're at a drive-through window at a restaurant, and you see the person, they're wearing gloves, but they sneeze or cough and cover their face, and then they hand you your debit card back that you've already handed them. What would you do?
Well, I can't give them my debit card and let them keep it.
Right.
Hey, I'll have to take it back.
I think I carry a lot of paper towels and napkins and things on the back seat of my passenger seat. There's a pocket for things like that. And if I have to touch something or when I get gas, I'll use those napkins.
Hold on just a minute. When you get gas, you use those. How do you use those napkins when you have gas, Johnny? Explain.
Not when I have gas. Gas, when I'm filling up my truck with gas. No, let me clear that up. I put the paper towel around the handle of the gas nozzle because pushing those buttons, they say, and touching those gas nozzles is one of the best ways to spread the COVID germs. So I do keep those in there. So if I do have to touch it, I also keep a hand sanitizer in my truck console right there, and I'll scrub down my card, my hands, and everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Let's move on. We've got a new segment on the show. We're going to play Who Am I? Okay, I'm going to give you some clues, Dr. Bill. And by the fifth clue, you have to know who am I. Okay?
Okay.
You get five All right, clues. Go ahead. Here's the first clue. They'll get...
Do I win something?
You win absolutely nothing.
Oh, yeah, that's what I figured. All right.
Number one, your first clue. Despite being raised in a Catholic family, this person veered his beliefs to the Church of Scientology around 1975. His interest started after he read through L. Ron Hubbard's book, Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, while on the set of The Devil's Reign. There's your first clue. Do you know who I am?
Now?
No, tomorrow at 3:30.
Hey, is it Stevie Wonder?
No, but that's actually, I was going to say it's a good guess, but it's really not a good guess. Stevie Wonder, no. No. Let me give you your second clue, though.
Okay.
Let's see if you get it. In 1985, at the Reagan White House, this person was able to show off his dance moves with Princess Diana. Not only did he prove he could shake those hips with ease, but he also impressed a member of royalty as well. Do you know who I am?
Well, hey, would it be Jaleel White?
Urkel from Family Matters.
Can I do that?
That's
Urkel
pretty,
could dance.
Yes, that's a pretty good guess, and I believe he actually has been to the White House before. I remember hearing about that, but no, it is not Urkel from Family Matters.
Okay.
Let me give you another hint. Here's three out of five. Before this person hit it big in the 70s, he was just a struggling actor trying to make ends meet. He took on several less than ideal jobs to pay his bills, including that of a supermarket checkout boy and an airline luggage porter. Do you know who I am?
Well, hey, it couldn't be Vince Vaughn, could it?
Oh, now that's a pretty good guess. Although Vince Vaughn, I think in that time frame, he was in the 70s. He would have been like 10 years old or less than.
Probably. Okay, probably not him.
So, yeah, so it's not him. But that one was actually a pretty good guess. That's a good guess. I could see him doing that. Here's your fourth clue here. In the early 70s, this person had minor roles in television programs and stage shows. But when he landed the character of Vinnie Barbarino on an ABC sitcom in 1975, he became a true household name. Do you know who I am?
Well, hey, it's got to be John Travolta.
Yes, welcome back, Cotta.
Hey, Cotta, up your nose with rubber hose.
That's right, yes. Did you sing the theme song?
Go for it, Dr. Bill. How's it go?
Welcome back. Your dreams
Everybody had the perms, and John Travolta had the long hair. Girls right, were crazy yeah. for him. He truly became a household name. You did it in right. four guesses. For those of you that would like to know the final clue, it was in 1971. This person was in the stage show cast of a musical 7 years before he landed the lead role in the movie adaptation. He was meant to play the character of Danny from the very beginning. So what movie do you think that is, Dr. Bill?
Well, I think it would be Grease.
Yes, I didn't know this. He was in the actual play version of this way back in 1971. The movie didn't come out until 78. So
I didn't know that either. I learned something from you.
Yeah, he was actually 23, and Olivia Newton-John was 29. Stockard Channing, who played Rizzo, she was 33 years old playing a high school student.
Hey, can you pronounce that song they sang together? You know, it's kind of a difficult term for me.
I can't remember.
Right. Well, that's not surprising.
Oh, the one at the end that they do when she's in the leather and... yeah. You're the one that I want. Ooh, 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 honey. That one?
No. No.
I'm so sorry y'all through that.
Moving along. Never mind.
Dr. Bill, we have got a great guest coming up on the show. Hollywood legend. She's been in several movies and several TV shows dating back to the 60s through the 70s, 80s, and 90s. She's been on shows like Dallas. She's been in huge movies with Richard Burton, Elvis Presley, and more. We're going to talk more about it. Her name is Diane McBain, and she is coming up next on Life and Laughs Podcast.
Here's a shout out from around the world on Life and Laughs Podcast.
Hi, this is Gina from Como, Italy, and I love listening to Life and Laughs Podcast.
Ciao, mi chiamo Janet e abito ad Avella in Italia e mi diverto e mi piace ascoltare LLP. Grazie.
Hi, I'm Maria Rosel Gonzalo from the Philippines and current listening to Life and Laughs Podcast.
This is Katie from Las Vegas and I never miss an episode of Life and Laughs Podcast. Donnie is the best.
Hello, everyone. This is Stella from Ontario, Canada. Up here, we absolutely love Johnny and Elias's podcast as much as we do our hockey and our Tim Hortons coffee.
Stella, thank you for rocking your wings. It was very nice.
That's all welcome. It was a beautiful show, and thank you for having us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Life and Laughs Podcast.
Hi, this is Diane McBain, and I am on Life and Laughs Podcast with Johnny and Elias.
Welcome to Life and Laughs Podcast. Johnny Sanchez here with my co-host from the West Coast, Elias Israel. And on our celebrity hotline right now is a legendary Hollywood actress who is known for her many appearances in iconic TV shows such as Surfside 6, Maverick, Batman, Dallas, and popular movies like Parrish, Spin Out, and many more, with such stars as James Garner, Roger Moore, Troy Donahue, Elvis Presley, Debbie Reynolds, Joan Crawford, the list goes on and on. She actually has a new book titled The Laughing Bear, available at Amazon.com. I'm thrilled to welcome the Life and Laughs Podcast, the wonderful Miss Diane McBain. Welcome, Diane.
Well, thank you, Johnny and Elias. Nice to see you, or talk to you, I should say.
Yes, ma'am.
I can't see you.
What an honor to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Now, you were born in Cleveland, Ohio. Tell us how you got from Cleveland to Hollywood. How did that happen?
Oh, well, my parents are responsible. It was during World War II, and my father was in the Mediterranean on a ship as a sailor, and my mother really got sick of the cold winters in Cleveland. And so she and my aunt and my grandmothers all packed up, and we moved to California. We came here on the train. You know those things that they used to travel on?
Yes.
It was probably a very long trip, because I do know that my mother told me a little story about how she had to get up and go to the restroom in the middle of the night, and the train lurched and my head hit her right in the eye, giving her a black eye.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Anyway, that was a long time ago.
So your parents, they didn't move you out there to pursue acting. That happened after you moved to Hollywood.
Oh, yes, many, many years after. I was a young teenager when I started acting at the Glendale Center Theater, which was a theater, obviously, in Glendale, California, where we lived. And I was encouraged to try out there, and I did. And I did several plays for them. And Sally Biano, who was the talent person at Warner Brothers Studios, was out looking for talent. And he came to our theater, and he saw me perform. And so he took me to Warner Brothers and introduced me to the people who were making a film called Ice Palace. And that was going to star Richard Burton and Robert Ryan and Carolyn Jones.
Wow.
I know those are names that a lot of people don't know anymore, but it was a very big film, and so they needed a young girl to play the ingenue role.
Wow. So right out of the gate, you're in with these legendary actors and actresses. That's incredible.
Yes, it was a very scary and, oh, life-altering experience, to say the least. And I wasn't really prepared. You know, even though I'd done some plays, I had never really done very much film at that time, although I did do a couple of TV shows for them before I started on the film. I did a Maverick. You know, you remember Jim Gardner?
Yes. And, actors. Yeah. Love him.
Okay. And I had that little tiny bit of experience, but it was very little. And here I was with Richard Burton. He was playing my grandfather, aged, of course. He was 32 at the time, but they aged him during this movie. Mm-hmm. It was a three-generational kind of film, and that was pretty scary.
Well, they signed you after seeing you just in the play that one time. Like you mentioned, they signed you right on the spot as a contract performer. Explain what a contract performer is and how that works.
Yes, well, that was a long time ago. They don't have contract performers any longer. The Warner Brothers had what they called a stable of actors, and they all got a weekly salary for 40 weeks out of the year. But Warner Brothers had complete control over what they would do at the studio, so they were assigned things. And I was assigned, obviously, to do Ice Palace, but I was also assigned to be in the television series Surfside 6, which was, you know, a kind of a popular show at the time, actually. It was very popular. So that's what it was. And they stopped doing that when the Sherman Antitrust Act came into play. The studios, they own theaters. And the Sherman Antitrust Act said, no, you can't own your own theaters because there's no room for any competition. And that was very true. And filmmaking actually blossomed after that happened, but it also meant that I no longer had a contract.
Oh, goodness. Oh, no.
So I was released from the studio and was on my own, which was also a life-changing experience.
When you were under contract, if you got an offer outside of the studio, were you able to take that offer, or does it mean you're exclusively with that one studio?
Yeah, well, they called those loan outs, and I still got the same amount of money as my contract called for, and it was paid by the studio. But they loaned me out to do a film with, oh dear, now I'm going to forget his name. Polly Bergen was in it. She was a star in it. And Joan Crawford was in it. You may remember her. And Robert Stack. I was supposed to be the romantic lead with Robert Stack.
Oh.
And so I was loaned to a producer outside of the studio, and we did the movie. It was a story about a psychiatrist who believed that institutional living for people who were having mental problems was not the healthiest thing to do with them. And he suggested halfway houses that would take a person who wasn't, you know, really bonkers and, you know, hitting their heads up against a wall, but were pretty stable. And then they would stay in these halfway houses. And it was a very new concept at the time. And that film was actually viewed at the White House.
Oh, wow.
Because they were interested in what, to do about mental illness and about mental institutions in the country,
wow,
which were not operating very well.
You're well known by this point at a young age, at 19, basically, 19, 20, you are one of the, I guess we could say, the it go-to girls for the studio, because you had a lot of success from your first movie. And so you're a gorgeous movie star now in Hollywood. You must have been sought after romantically by some of these celebrities that you worked with. Any celebrity dates you can tell us about?
Well, maybe I really shouldn't. I don't know. But they're all gone now, so I suppose it doesn't matter. Richard Burton took a fancy to me, which was very flattering. Troy and I had a very close friendship, and it never really turned into a romance, although we did try to make it a romance, but it didn't quite make it. And Lee Patterson and I had some time together. He was in the series with us. And let's see, who else? you know, there were quite a few people in my life at the time, and I enjoyed meeting a lot of very famous people from different walks of life, actually. I don't know if you would remember Pancho Gonzalez, but he was a famous tennis player at the time.
Okay.
And we dated for quite some time.
I have one to ask you about that I saw you post on your Facebook page, a picture not long ago, was the big TV mogul Aaron Spelling.
Oh, yes. Well, yes, Aaron and I dated for a little while, and he actually asked my dad if he could ask me to marry him.
Whoa.
My dad said, sure, you know. But it's her choice, you know. It wasn't like my dad had any control over me at all. But I thought it was very gallant that he asked my father if it would be okay.
Sure. So why did that never take place? What happened there?
Well, he just didn't appeal to me that much. And I wish, of course, that he had. he certainly turned in to be quite a large, huge producer. He was on his way up at the time, and he was famous for his work. But, you know, I just, this very independent young woman, and I just didn't take to him that much. I'm sorry about that. I really am, because he was a nice man. He really was.
Yeah, you probably are reminded of that every time you drive by that Spelling house out there.
Yeah. Well, it's a little big for me, though. I don't think I could have been happy
Yeah. You mentioned Troy Donahue. Your chemistry on screen with him in Surfside 6 was so great that they matched you two together in the movie Parish in 1961, as well as Connie Stevens. Now, that film was a hit, made over $4 million. So how did your life change after the success of that film?
Well, it was pretty successful. I did another film called Claudelle English, and I starred in that as the title role, which was quite a wonderful opportunity to do some serious acting. And that was wonderful. Let me see what else came out of that. There were, the rest of my career pretty much came out of that period of time.
I know in 1963, you were in the movie Caretakers with Joan Crawford, who I heard made things a little bit difficult for you. Tell us about that experience.
Yes, it was very, very difficult. And that was the movie I was loaned out for with Robert Stack and Polly Bergen.
Okay.
And quite a few of us were in that. Even Van Williams was in that with me as well. And she, we went to the set prior to my start date. And I had gone out to lunch with my friend, who was so enamored with Joan Crawford, he couldn't keep himself. You know, he was just so excited about meeting her. And he insisted that I dress up in a beautiful outfit for lunch and a picture hat. And so we marched on to the set after lunch, and there she was standing there. And she took one look at me and said, oh. And I don't know what she was really thinking, but that the expression on her face was not positive.
Yeah.
But anyway, Robbie, my friend, was very, very excited about meeting her, and he just didn't, you know, he only noticed this as an afterthought, that it probably was the reason why she didn't like me. And Joan had what they called the completion bond on the film. That meant that the money would be there to complete the film, but only if she wanted it to be. So the director was very beholden to her. And so she had a great deal of control over how the film was done.
Right.
And so she made sure that any time we were in a scene together, that I would be kind of sidelined.
Oh, no.
Yes. So my role became smaller and smaller and smaller, and she had all of the romantic stuff with Robert Stack and I taken out of the film.
Oh, what?
Yeah, and so I ended up, you know, kind of almost an afterthought in that movie, practically an extra by the time she got finished.
So she was that intimidated by you, apparently, because in your movies, I mean, even then you were gorgeous. I mean, you stayed gorgeous throughout your life. For those of you that may not be familiar with Diane, which I know the majority of us are, but she was a knockout, gorgeous, young beauty. And I can see why Joan may be intimidated by you walking onto a set that she wants all the attention.
Well, she was. And in the film, she was a nurse, sort of a nurse ratchet type.
Yeah.
And so she was not attractive in that film at all. And, you know, she felt threatened. She did. And it was understandable. But, you know, what she did was really, I thought, unconscionable. You know, I wouldn't have done that, even though I suppose I would have been threatened by a young starlet under the same circumstances.
Yeah.
But, you know, she was who she was. And she was very, extremely competitive. And that was her, you know, her doing. Yeah. So anyway, it turned out fine. Like I said, the film was viewed at the White House, and it was important that the system of institutionalism come to an end, and I'm glad it did.
Yeah.
Because people were just going crazier in these institutions rather than getting better.
Well, yeah. I have a quote here from you where you once said, "I was very stupid about money. My mother had always made my clothes and I was embarrassed about it. I became a shopaholic and spent a fortune on store-bought clothes." You said, "Tammy Baker probably copied the way I did my shopping and eyelashes." Was it really so bad that it caused any maybe financial problems for you? Was it that bad of an addiction?
Well, it was an addiction for sure. A shopping addiction, I guess they would call it.
Yeah.
It was, definitely. And it did. It cost me. What I should have been doing at the time was investing in property out in Woodland Hills.
Sure. Really?
Because it was very cheap at the time and undeveloped. And I could have made a small fortune if I had done that. But I was very stupid about it, and I didn't care much about, and I never really cared much about money, to be honest. It was hard for me to really get all that interested in having it. And I always sort of thought, well, when I get married, my husband will certainly be able to take care of me. So why should I worry about it? Those were my justifications. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I did notice also, because in a lot of your films, probably the majority, you were usually cast, especially when you were younger, as a bad girl or maybe a spoiled rich girl type on film and TV. Did that bother you?
Yeah, it did. I always wanted to play, you know, other kinds of roles, but they kind of tapped me as the femme fatale. And that's what I ended up doing mostly in television, actually, as time rolled on. It became more of my career than the filming, the major films. So, but, you know, that's the kind of a character that I usually played. And it bothered me. It did. I wanted to do other things. But, you know, in those days, it was different. And especially during the 60s, I mean, rock and roll and all of that.
Sure.
It was just a different time. And my type actually was starting to go out of fashion, because in the mid 60s, there was the revolution against the war. The kids, you know, were all against the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And they were starting to live a very different lifestyle. And movies were taking up young girls who were pretty. They were pretty, but they just weren't glamour girls.
Right.
And I was a bit of a glamour girl because I had blonde hair, you know.
Yeah.
Right.
Kind of types you. Anyway, if people want to see what I looked like then, they can go to my Facebook page.
Yes.
And see me, and or they can even Google me. Just put my name in Google and go straight to some menus that
Yes, one of the most gorgeous girls of your era, for sure. The first, I have to say, the first movie that I saw you in was an Elvis Presley movie. We're Elvis fans here. We've done some Elvis podcast series with family and friends, but the movie Spin Out, I just thought, for me, you know, you took the attention away from Elvis, and not many people can do that, you know, and so.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I wouldn't have said that, but okay, thank you. I appreciate it. That movie actually played on TCM, Turner Classic Movies, just a little over a week ago.
Yeah,
it was. And I didn't get to watch it because I was busy doing something else. But it was a fun movie to do with Elvis. And he was a charming fellow. I liked him a lot. And we had a nice rapport.
Did you ever date Elvis? Did he ask you out on a date?
No. I wasn't really his type. He liked darker girls. He liked brunettes. Mm-hmm. And I was a blonde. So I was not his preference, but we were friends and we got to be very friendly. And I really appreciated that because honestly, I wasn't sure I would want to go out with him anyway because his lifestyle was just so difficult. Yeah. It was difficult.
Yeah.
And he had a coterie of men who followed him around and took care of his every need. And of course, the women who could tolerate that were the ones who got caught up with him. But it doesn't appeal to me at all.
Yeah.
But he did as a person. And we had some very wonderful discussions on the set and had a good friendship. Yeah.
So he was very nice to you. Was he prepared on the set? A lot of people think he got star treatment being in his movies.
Well, he did. He certainly did. No, he was prepared. He was good. He was good at what he did, and he wanted to be an actor. So whenever he had an opportunity, even though they were kind of flimsy little movies that he did, he still was interested in proving that he could be an actor. So he was prepared. He did his work.
I got to ask you about this because in August 1965, your parents reported you as missing. It turned out you had checked into a hotel in San Diego under the name Marilyn Miller, saying you had been despondent over maybe slackening income, maybe not getting the type of roles you wanted. What led to that event in your life at the age of 24?
Well, my parents had borrowed my car to take a 2-week road trip. That was a Lincoln Continental, and it was a nice car. And I borrowed their car in the meantime. And I was living in close to Beverly Hills, right? Adjacent Beverly Hills. I had a house, and I was getting despondent because I wasn't getting the roles that I had hoped I could have. And I, you know, was kind of struggling. And so I just decided to take off, and I drove their car down to the Coronado Hotel near San Diego. And it's a beautiful place, and I remembered it because I had been there before, and I loved it. And I thought, well, you know, that would be a nice respite from, certainly from fame, because I didn't want to be recognized while I was there. And I wanted to meet people, humans, you know, real humans.
Yeah.
There weren't a lot around me at the time. And so I thought, well, this is a way to do it. I'll meet some people and, you know, we'll hang out and we'll do stuff, right?
Right.
And so my parents, you know, God bless them, they came home a little bit early from their vacation and discovered that I was gone. And they didn't know where I went. They had no idea. We didn't have cell phones back then. Right. So I didn't let them know, you know. So they were scared. They were afraid that something might have happened to me because there had been some incidences. A fan, for instance, on one occasion walked up onto my driveway when I was doing some gardening. And, you know, I had told them about that, and they kind of felt a little insecure about
sure,
my safety.
Sure, yeah.
So they were terrified. So my dad went over to a police station near where they lived and reported me missing. And a reporter happened to be there at the time, wouldn't you know it, and happened to overhear the conversation with the people at the police station. Then all hell broke loose. And it was very embarrassing, actually. I felt very I shouldn't have done this. I'm sorry. And I put everybody into a situation that was very unpleasant for everyone, my family especially, because they were terrified.
Yeah. In 1967, during the second season of the ABC series Batman, you played socialite Pinky Pinkston, a friend of Batman alias Bruce Wayne. Now, you had pink hair, pink outfits, and a pink dog. What did you enjoy most about that role?
Well, actually, what I remember most about it, of course, the pink stuff, that was difficult to cope with because of the dogs and the hair and all that stuff. But the other thing that I remembered most about it was that it was a combined show between Batman and the Green Hornet. And they put those two shows together, and my friend Van Williams, who had been in a couple of things, the Surfside Six was the series that we did together, and then The Caretakers, the movie, we did that together. And so here, you know, we were together again, and it was a lot of fun to see him and to work with him again. Well, we just had a good time. Yeah.
That show has become such an iconic show that it's made you kind of a cult figure in that show. Do you ever attend any Comic Cons and those type events?
No, I haven't. Not that I wouldn't. I just haven't. You know, and traveling for me now is a little difficult.
Sure.
I don't like to fly that much. The airplanes, the way they run everything is difficult for me. So I kind of stay away from traveling now. So unless they come to my part of the country and my part of the world in my city, I'm not really interested in doing that.
Within a 3-mile perimeter.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Well, let's skip ahead to the 70s, to the 1970s. You kind of slowed your career somewhat to care for your son, Evan.
Evan.
So, that's my son's name also.
Well, that's a terrific name.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Now, you continued, you did continue to make guest appearances in a number of television series into the 80s, such as The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, Hawaii Five-O, Charlie's Angels, Eight is Enough, Days of Our Lives, Dallas and Knight Rider. I've always wondered what it was really like working with Larry Hagman. What was your experience with that on the cast of Dallas?
Well, Larry was a cool fellow. He was a very nice fellow. But I didn't work with him directly in that. Now, I can't remember her name. Isn't that awful? But anyway, not remembering her name, but I was paired with her more than with any of the male characters in that show.
Did you get along well with other female actresses? Because I've heard stories how a lot of times that's kind of chaotic when female actresses are on the same set, at least back on some of those shows in the 70s and 80s. Did you experience any issues there?
Well, it can be difficult, but not because of me, because I'm always a very friendly person. I have no interest in being competitive with these people. I like people, but if they have a problem with me, then I'll probably have a problem with them, depending on their personality and so on. But,
it's when you show up in that big hat.
Oh, well, if I show up in that big hat, then I'm in big trouble, aren't I?
Yep, that's the curse.
What about the girls like on Charlie's Angels? Because that was all the leads in that were female. Did you get along well with those girls?
Yeah, I got along fine. I didn't have any problems with them. They were very nice. They were very busy, so they didn't have much time to spend with me. But it was fine. It was fine. We got along just fine. No problem.
You also work steadily in regional theater, which I love. I've done several plays, so I know what that is like. So what did you like most about working in theater as opposed to TV and film?
Well, you know, I preferred film, probably because I was more used to film than I was to doing stage work.
Sure.
But I enjoyed it. It was fun. It could be fun. I did Star Spangled Girl at one point, and that was traveling with Eddie Burns and Carlton Carpenter. And Eddie, well, he came on to me the first night of we were there. We were in a hotel in New York City in rehearsal, and he came on to me, and I just wasn't interested in Eddie, and I think he was even married at the time, so I wasn't going to hook up with him. So I kind of turned him down, and from that point on, he turned the cold eye to me. He just, became very chilly. And Carlton, God bless him, was a wonderful person and a great actor. He was gay. And so he was going to hang out with me. You know, he wanted to hang out with his, friends. So anyway, we had a good time when we were working. But when we were not working, it was kind of a lonely time. But I did meet some interesting people. I met a lady who was the heiress of the Otis fortune.
Wow.
Otis Elevators.
Yeah.
Whoa.
But she was a very simple human being. She was lovely. I really enjoyed her company. I stayed at her house, and it was a very old house in Connecticut, I believe that was. It was like a 200-year-old house.
Oh.
And she would take me to these graveyards, and we would do grave rubbings. Have you ever done that?
No.
Or do you even know what it is?
No. I have an idea, but why don't you tell us before I embarrass myself?
Okay. Well, they were very old graves back in Connecticut. I mean, these were graves from the 1800s.
Wow.
And there were a lot of children, babies, that died early in life.
Mm-hmm.
And a grave rubbings was you took the headstone and you took a piece of special paper and then you took a pen. Well, it was more of like a charcoal thing, and you rubbed it against the gravestone. And when you were through, you would have the outline of the names and the dates of the people who had passed away and whose gravestone they were.
Yeah.
So it was a representation of the gravestone. Yeah.
I love that. Oh. I love going to look at, and when I'm in cemeteries, at the headstones of, the older dates, especially the ones that have little stories. I'm very interested in history and people that came before us like that. I think that's really cool.
Well, you live in that part of the world, don't you? I mean, in the South, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of history there for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, there really is. Well, let's skip ahead now to the 1990s when you appeared, and some of our younger viewers may be aware of one of these shows, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. I think you played the grandmother of the lead character in that, Melissa Joan Hart.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed doing that. She was a charming little girl. And, we worked well together. And she was easy to be with and to work with. And it was kind of a fun role. I was a ghost.
Yeah. So are there any differences, which I'm sure there are, maybe you can tell us some of the differences between TV sets, for example, when you did that show as compared to when you first started out in TV, the way things are done, or are they still pretty similar?
Well, no, they are pretty similar. TV is extremely difficult because there's so little time to accomplish some important things. Like, for instance, it takes 7 days to film an hour show. And 7 days compared to 2 or 3 months on a major motion picture is, a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're pressured to be, Johnny on the spot. You've got to be ready and you have to be available and you have to be able to perform quickly and do it in one or two takes at the most and things like that. So that's difficult and that's a lot of pressure. So that was a major difference, but it was always the same. It was true back in the early 60s doing television. Our shows, we, 7 day schedule and that was it. And you had to do what you had to do and you had to do it well right away. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you were on several other shows as well. Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, Invisible Mom 2, The Young and the Restless, and Days of Our Lives. Did you like doing soap operas?
Yeah, it was okay. I mean, that there again, in that case, you have 1 day to film an hour show. Just 1 day. It's not 7 days. It's 1 day.
Okay.
So that is a lot of pressure, a lot of pressure. And you have to do it in no more than one take. They just won't do another take if, if you have to or if you feel like you want to. Well, no, forget it. You can't do that. So you have to be prepared and you get one rehearsal and then you film and that's it. Then you're done. And that's very difficult to accomplish. I did it, obviously. And it was kind of interesting to meet some of the people who were on the shows and stuff like that. But, that was difficult. That was very difficult.
Well, you've had an impressive body of work for sure. And you also began writing screenplays. What made you decide to start writing?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer and never really had much of an opportunity. I was so busy filming and doing things that supported the filming that I didn't have time to really do any writing. And then, so, you know, later on, as time wore on, I wasn't quite so busy and I had the time. And so I thought, well, I'm going to try doing some screenplays and see if I can't sell a screenplay, which I never did, by the way. I really wish I had, but I couldn't. I put my effort in and wrote quite a few. And I wrote one about the Tiananmen Square massacre. We went to China to research that quite secretly, as a matter of fact. My partner and I were guests of the Chinese government to look at their criminal justice system, which is different from ours, as you know. Mm-hmm. And my partner was a judge in Northern California, appointed by Jerry Brown. And he had an institute where they had an exchange program between the Chinese and the Americans going. We would go there and they would come here and look at our criminal justice system. And so I went as his assistant. But really what I was doing was researching the screenplay. Oh. And so I had quite a few opportunities to do that, but I had to do it very secretly, clandestinely. And it was a good screenplay. You know, Paramount looked at it for a while, but, you know, it was kind of a touchy subject, I think, politically between the U.S. and China.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe they didn't want to do it because of that kind of stress. So it didn't get done. I'm sad to say. It's still a good screenplay, though, if anybody's interested.
Yeah, maybe someday. Maybe someone will pick that up someday.
You never know. You never know. But anyway, further, once I was retired and I had the time, I started to do some more writing, and mostly it was experimental. And then one day I looked at what I was writing, journalizing, basically, and I said, you know, I could turn this into a novel. Why don't I try to do that? So I did. I, you know, started working on the novel that turned out to be The Laughing Bear, which is now published. You can get it on Amazon.com. You can get it in a hard copy or a soft copy, or you can even get it on Kindle, if you like.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly good story, I think. It's about four people who, three of them are approaching old age, and one of them is a bit younger, but in his 40s. And it's about unfinished business. When you get to be a little bit older in your life, you know, you start looking at things and saying, wait a minute, you know, I really wanted to do this. Mm-hmm. And why didn't I ever get that done? And so it's about getting those things done. So it's about four people who are associated because they live at a bed and breakfast called the Laughing Bear Bed and Breakfast.
Okay.
In a charming little town called Dancing Bear Springs in California Mountain. The characters, I think, are quite charming and lovely, based on some real people, but I fictionalized it completely. I did nothing in it other than the characters of the people were real. But, you know, I did use these people that I knew as characters. So,
Right.
Yeah. Well, they say write what you know, and that's what I knew, exactly. So I did that. I think it's a pretty good novel. I think that people should enjoy it, especially people over the age of 30 who are starting to look at their life in a slightly different way and saying, wait a minute, you know, maybe I ought to take care of this before I get to be too old.
Right. So.
Yeah, I look forward to reading that. You did a few years back an autobiography, I believe, Famous Enough, a Hollywood memoir?
That's correct. Yes, I did write that. And I had a partner, Michael Bichot, who is a wonderful person and a very good friend who has done a great deal for me as a person and certainly as a writer. He knew that I had written my life story. And he called me one day saying, you know, I have this book out about Sal Mineo. It was doing pretty well. It was a good publishing company. And he said, I want to follow it up with something, but I don't have anything at the moment. So would you mind if we partnered on it? I will edit your piece. I will add anything that seems to be missing, and there were a lot of things missing. I kind of skipped over a lot of television stuff and, you know, things that I didn't really care about that much. And so he came in and he filled in those gaps and he threw out some things that were, you know, completely unnecessary. and he helped me a lot with it, and he also helped me get it published. So that's been a long partnership that we've had, and yeah. It's been quite successful. Yeah.
They're both still available, I believe, at Amazon.com.
Yes, they are. Yes, and I highly recommend my memoir. I think it's well-written. It's very truthful. I didn't mince any words about my life. I included the embarrassing stuff and told the true story of my life, and it's all in there. So, or at least up until the time I retired and got on with the writing part of my life.
Right? Yeah. Well, yeah. You were talking about, you know, looking back on your life and what you, with the Laughing Bear, what that kind of was about. And that kind of made me think, are there any things in your life that you look back over and your career possibly that you would you do it again? Or are there things that you would have done differently? And maybe what are some of those?
I would do it again, but I would do it differently.
Maybe worn a different hat, maybe no hat that day.
No hat. You're right, absolutely. I would not wear the hat, and I probably would have dressed a little more frumpily. You know, I would have, you know, not presented yep. myself as a glamour queen.
Wouldn't so easily be led by your friend's suggestions.
Right, yes. So, no hat, but when I left Warner Brothers, that's what I was trying to say, I would have gone to New York and tried my hand in stage work, because I think that would have helped me a lot as an actor, a performer, and certainly, you know, it might have even helped my career, because people might have looked at me more as an actress rather than just a glamour girl. And yeah. I think that would have made a difference. I certainly always wanted to get married and have a family, and I just didn't do that very well. When I finally did get married, my husband and I were together for 18 months, and that was it. I just wasn't good at marriage.
Yeah,
I was too independent, is the truth of it. Even though I wanted to have a family, the only thing I was managed to do was to have a son named Evan. He's a lovely young man, but I'm afraid, you know, that was it. I couldn't add anything more to my family, and I would like to have done that if I could have.
What are you most proud of in your life today?
Well, actually, I'm most proud of the writing I'm doing.
Okay.
To me, this is like the career I might have had I not been an actress. I probably would have sat down and started writing a lot sooner than I did, because I did want to do that, and it was something that I was pretty good at. You know, that would have been quite a big change. If I hadn't been an actor, I would have done that. So, you know, but life is what it is. You have to take it as it comes. Even though some of us are very privileged, nobody has it really easy. You have to struggle. Everybody has to struggle over something. And I certainly had to struggle over my issues, as anybody else would have to struggle. But that it's all good, because it makes for a full life. And when you retire, then you can start to do some of the things that you would have done had you, you know, had more time as a younger person. Yeah. And that's an important thing, I think. I would say to older people, don't give up. You can always start over again.
For sure. Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you think back over your life, how would you like people to remember you?
Oh, dear. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, they're going to remember how they remember, whatever. You know, some of the things that I might have done had I gone to New York, for instance, and polished my acting skills a little bit and gotten known to be an actress instead of a glamour girl, maybe that would have been nice to be known as, you know, more of an actress than a glamour puss. And so that would have been good. But, you know, like I said, you have to take it as it comes, and, you know, it doesn't always work out exactly the way you want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can get your new novel, it's called The Laughing Bear, as well as your autobiography, Famous Enough, A Hollywood Memoir, at Amazon.com.
That's right.
And you can find out more about you on your Facebook page. You just search Diane McBain.
That's all you have to do, is put that into your search engine and it will go. And by the way, I finished another novel.
Oh, really?
It is now in the works to be published pretty soon, I'm hoping anyway. And it's called The Color of Hope. And I'm hoping that it will do really well. It's a story that's way out of my comfort zone, way out of my comfort zone. But I think it's a really good story. I researched it, and I think I did a pretty good job. So I hope that in the future, people will look for The Color of Hope.
Yeah, it's a great title.
By Diane McCain.
Yeah, we'll definitely check your Facebook page and keep in contact with you and be looking for that. In the meantime, Elias and I are going to get your new one, The Laughing Bear. We're going to read that and talk about that on an upcoming episode. Maybe we'll have you back on to talk about it.
Oh, that would be wonderful. I'd love to talk about the book in more depth and detail. That would be great. Yeah,
this has really been a pleasure. We'd loved having you on here. I'm going to go watch all your movies and some of the ones that I haven't seen yet, but the ones I have seen, I'm a huge fan of yours, and I'm just so appreciative of you being here today.
Well, thank you very much, Tony. It's been great. And you too, Elias. Take care.
Thank you.
Hi to your son, Evan, for me. Okay?
I'll tell him.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed my time.
Thanks so much for joining us today on Life and Laughs Podcast. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast, and go ahead and click on that little bell button. That way you'll get notified each and every time we release a new episode. You can hear the audio podcast as well as get links to our Facebook and Instagram accounts. It's all on our website at lifeandlaughs.simplecast.com. On behalf of my co-host from the West Coast, Elias Israel, I'm Johnny Sanchez. We'll see you next time on Life and Laughs Podcast.